Welcome to Wild Trekker. I'm George Toombs here in Montreal, and this is the 18th episode. Wild Trekker is a series of podcasts, a writer's notebook, audio chapters from ongoing works, soundscapes, adventures, interviews with fascinating people, reflections, original radio plays, reportage, stories behind stories, jam sessions, and more. Wild Trekker is a fluid kind of sound art. I hope you enjoy it. This is the first episode in a new 7-part series I call Dream World. This series has to do with the meeting ground of the real and the imagined, the place where authors like me dream up and write our novels. I realize there's a whole science devoted to dreams, where they come from, how they form in our minds while we sleep, what they mean, whether or not we remember them afterwards. Science is in the expository and logico-deductive modes and is based on abstractions, which are decontextualized ideas, epitomized and unclothed. Science can provide insights into dreaming, but it will not help us grasp the landscapes and textures and characters and events in our dreams, or why dreams are an integral part of the process of literary creation. In fact, dreams are closely associated with myth and metaphor, two pillars of storytelling. As I was growing up in a village along the St. Lawrence River near Montreal, I spoke two languages, English and French, rather than just one. This meant switching back and forth whenever I spoke to family, friends, and neighbors. I realized there wasn't just one way of saying things. I was aware, even as a child, that words represented things. But words sounded differently in each language. They had different flavors and tones and colors, so they didn't represent things quite the same way. A language came with so many associations. It created a kind of complicity between speaker and listener. A language could throw up barriers just as it could open doors. I felt it was a wonderful opportunity to speak in English and French. I was determined, even as a child, to become completely bilingual, to speak, read, and write interchangeably in both English and French. But since it was second nature to me to switch back and forth between English and French, I was faced with a paradox. I actually felt detached from each language, as if I could see, just beyond the conversation I was engaged in, a whole other range of meanings in the other language. In my 20s, I spent 5 years working for the BBC World Service, doing freelance dispatches, interviews, two-ways, features, and tape docs. At the BBC, I got my basic training in writing. They taught me to compose word pictures. I'd never heard the term word pictures before. I felt it was an ambivalent term. It opened the way to storytelling, but already signaled the limitations of language. As a writer and translator, I probably should uphold the value of language, but I often find words wanting. Music goes more directly to the emotions than words. Film appeals to people on many different levels at once, and therefore strikes me as a more complete art than writing. Some things we perceive as real are shaped by our imagination, and some things we perceive as imagined are conditioned by what we know of reality. But I wonder if we can picture a symbolic level at which the real meets with the imagined. I remember an evening on board a cargo ship, heading down the St. Lawrence River just past Tadoussac. We were bound for the Arctic on a supply voyage where I was going to do a documentary for CBC Radio. The pom-pom-pom of the engines astern, the rush of waves shimmering with the weird glow of phosphorescent algae suspended in the water, a puff now and then of fir trees on the shore, mingling with the scent of salt droplets borne in the summer breeze. I stood alone by the rail, amidships. I could just make out the gash on land where the Laurentian Mountains roll down to the sea and the freshwater Saguenay merges with salt water. As the moon rose to the east over Trois Pistoles, I spotted two enormous creatures. Were they humpback whales, feeding at the surface, blowing a column of silvery mist in the moonlight, then diving? I headed for the stern to watch the propeller lob rounded masses of water up to the surface, hissing and gurgling and frothing. This movement of water reminded me of what lies above the surface, and what lies below the surface of our imagination. I keep thinking of the surface of the sea. The Oxford English Dictionary defines the word surface as the upper limit of a body of liquid, and a continuous set of points that has length and breadth but no thickness. This means the surface is not so much a barrier as a permeable covering or a conceptual limit or a reflective image like a thin stretched membrane. We can dip below it, we can dive through it. In dreaming we lose our inhibitions. We dare to penetrate the upper surface of the imagination, reaching a deep-seated level where we encounter our instincts and memories, the emotions we might not even recognize in our waking hours, our loves, fantasies, and fears, unfathomable reservoirs of anxiety and distress, the stunning mindscapes of the dream world, and motivations driving us forward when we're fully conscious. The stuff of writing comes from this other world, below the surface, where we encounter sirens and other primeval creatures of the deep that inhabit our inner life. Dreams light up our imagination, feeding us with new symbols that help us navigate around experience during our waking hours. I believe this dream world, a private realm or mythology of the unconscious, is where a lot of storytelling comes from. To create is to transform. Authors, in publishing their fiction, make this private realm of their imagination public, but they also take us back to the mythical, intuitive level of meaning. summer, a light breeze is stirring the fragrant branches of a cypress tree on a Greek island in the Aegean Sea. You're staying in a village, and when you go out for your evening walk, you are spellbound by the song of a nightingale perched on a branch. As you listen to its chirps and warbling and rising whistle, you wonder, why can't people sing like that? If you think about the timeline of singing in the world, then you should be interested in an article in the scientific journal Nature published in 2016. A researcher at the University of Texas in Austin describes the voice organ in a fossilized bird on Vega Island in Antarctica, a fossilized bird from 66 million years ago, a bird closely related to ducks and geese nowadays. This fossilized bird, now extinct, was able to sing. And there have been countless species of birds singing since that time. Now consider what two researchers at the University of Liverpool wrote in the scientific journal PLOS ONE in 2013. Based on their study of cerebral brain flows, early human ancestors began to make complex stone tools and also to speak language about 1.75 million years ago. They may have been grunting and clicking and chirping and quacking and screeching and humming before that, especially while hunting birds, but the combination of song and speech would seem to go back to that era. So birds have been singing for at least 66 million years, and humans have been speaking for 1.75 million years. It stands to reason that humans were inspired to sing by birds. I would say humans also learned the art of poetry from birds, and I'm not the only person to think so. Consider the following lines from the romantic poet Percy Bysshe Shelley. A poet is a nightingale who sits in darkness and sings to cheer its own solitude with sweet sounds. His auditors are as men entranced by the melody of an unseen musician who feel that they are moved and softened, yet know not whence or why. In Shelley's lines is something more than the poet as nightingale. Shelley knew that the drama of being a writer is spending endless amounts of time in solitude, crafting words and stories in order to communicate with people one will never meet. Now, when it comes to writing, distinctions are often made between four common modes of writing: the descriptive, expository, narrative, and persuasive. Some people add a fifth mode, the imaginative mode of writing. A novel is narrative and imaginative, using symbols, myth, and metaphor. The narrative mode involves storytelling. Poetry is imaginative, using symbols, myth, and metaphor. Epic poetry gets into storytelling. One has only to think of the Epic of Gilgamesh or the Odyssey. But shorter poems are bursts of energy, like bolts of lightning. Journalism is descriptive, expository, and sometimes intended to be persuasive. I remember 2 years I spent as an editorial writer at the Montreal Gazette. My editorials were supposed to be persuasive, although I often wondered whether they really were. Feature writing and documentaries are narrative. Creative nonfiction uses journalistic techniques, but as a work of imagination, incorporates symbols, myth, and metaphor. My book, Robber Baron, is a work of creative nonfiction. I would defend my research and statements in that book as factually accurate, but I sometimes made digressions, alluding to symbols, myth, and metaphor, and asking questions which I couldn't answer, since I realized facts alone could not tell the story. Scientific writing is expository and logico-deductive. It's based on scientific data, which are abstractions. The Oxford English Dictionary defines the word abstract as existing in thought or as an idea, but not having a physical or concrete existence. The dictionary also says abstraction is the process of considering something independently of its associations or attributes. An abstraction is an idea decontextualized, epitomized, unclothed. Science popularization is expository but also narrative, since it involves converting scientific data into stories rich in symbols, which means changing the level of meaning. Science popularization reclothes the abstractions of scientific data by recontextualizing them.
Αποκάλυψης κεφάλαιων 21 και είδων ουρανών κενών και γην κενήν. Ο γαρ πρώτος ουρανός και η πρώτη γη απήλθον και η θάλασσα ούκα εστιν έτη. Και την πόλην την Αγίαν Ιερουσαλήμ κενήν είδων καταβαίνουσαν εκ του ουρανού από του Θεού ητιμασμένην ως νύμφιν και κοσμημένην το Ανδρία αυτής.
Sacred writings, like the Bible, are narrative, imaginative, and persuasive, focusing on myth and metaphor, creating cosmologies, and seeking to reinforce belief. But how should we interpret the Bible? As a collection of stories? As a series of writings, often derived from oral traditions, over a 2,000-year period, combining inspired poetry, prayers, history, prophecy, psalms, proverbs, visions, nightmares, demonology, parables? The Church Fathers in the early centuries of Christianity proposed using four methods of interpretation to study the written text of the Bible. They sometimes cited the example of the Roman quadriga, or four-horse chariot, to remind people how to keep these four methods in mind. Things could be taken at the literal level, the anagogic, the allegorical, and the moral. I find these four methods interesting, especially because using the quadriga as a metaphor means explaining one metaphor by another metaphor. A Latin rhyme helped medieval scholars remember these four methods. Litera gesta docet, quid credas allegoria, moralis quid agas, votendas anagogia. My late uncle Robert M. Grant translated this as, "The literal teaches what God and our ancestors did. The allegory is where our faith and belief is hid. The moral meaning gives us the rule of daily life. The anagogy shows us where we end our strife." Well, this medieval Latin rhyme seems archaic nowadays, but as an artifact of another time and place, it is interesting. And the idea that there could be four different ways to interpret a written text strikes me as valid. I would like to take a moment to recall the words of the Anglo-Argentine naturalist W.H. Hudson, who devoted a great deal of attention to the study of birds, both in his native Argentina and in Great Britain, where he eventually settled. In 1893, Hudson writes, "Doubtless man is naturally scientific, and finds out why things are not what they seem, and gets to the bottom of all mysteries, but his older, deeper, primitive, still persistent nature is non-scientific and mythical, and in spite of reason he wonders at the change. It is miracle, a manifestation of intelligent life and power that is in all things." According to Hudson, an accomplished scientist, man has two complementary natures, not just one. Hudson might have thought of two complementary human natures running in parallel. I believe we have one nature above the surface and another below the surface, but it amounts to the same. Actually, dreams are stories we tell ourselves while we sleep. They're in the narrative and imaginative modes. They use stunningly vivid symbols and metaphors. What do we mean by myth? Our word myth nowadays is derived from the ancient Greek mythos, and I'm not using myth in the sense some people use it as a stand-in for fables or widely held but false beliefs. In the 4th century BC, Aristotle wrote in the Poetics that mythos is one of the 6 traditional elements of tragedy. Mythos is a plot which can be transmitted. According to the Canadian literary critic Northrop Frye, a myth is primarily a mythos, a story, narrative, or plot with a specific social function. Every human society has a verbal culture, and in the pre-literary phase, when abstract thought has not developed, the bulk of this culture consists of stories. In the 4th century BC, Aristotle's teacher, Plato, used myths to illustrate meaning symbolically, to help his listeners grasp philosophical concepts more easily, to persuade them as well. Plato's myths range from the allegory of the cave to the wings of the soul, and the myth of early man to the myth of the upper world and the real earth. Surely, the most powerful of all these is the myth of Atlantis. He writes of an ideal commonwealth, the island of Atlantis, situated 9,000 years before the birth of Solon. Poseidon wisely inaugurated peace, prosperity, and a spirit of sharing on the island. Under his benevolent reign, the Atlantean people enjoyed considerable wealth because of mines located on their island, as well as regular seaborne commerce. They had an abundance of wood, elephants, racehorses, pastures, grasses, and fruit-bearing trees. They built a beautiful city of palaces and temples, golden statues, canals, aqueducts, and every refinement known to man. And although the dialogue ends abruptly, we're left to understand that Zeus inflicted severe punishment on the Atlanteans. Other traditions maintained that the fabled city of 9,000 years beforehand was engulfed by the sea. Novelists use myth all the time, not like Plato for didactic purposes, but as compelling storylines that offer meaning to readers. The English word fiction comes from the Latin fingere, which means to imagine. Fiction is an imagined story with an overarching theme, plots, settings, characters, dialogue, and a narrative arc or time frame. I mentioned earlier that abstractions are decontextualized, epitomized, unclothed ideas. Abstractions are typical of scientific writing, which is in the logico-deductive mode. A novel is not a series of abstractions. It is rather a work providing context, clothing imagined scenes, and giving characters an air of reality or magic in ways that enable the reader to identify with them at a deep level. Imagine you're leaving the Greek island in the Aegean Sea, where you've been listening to that wonderful nightingale. Now you're heading for the bustling city of Athens. Here and there, along the streets, you will see signs outside shops saying Metaphora Chrimaton. The logos of MoneyGram and Western Union may be more familiar to you than the original Greek. These are places to transfer money, because the modern Greek word metaphora means transfer. Metaphors are just as important for creative writing as myth is. In ancient Greece, a metaphor meant a transfer or exchange. The main thing to bear in mind here is that a metaphor implies a relationship between two different nouns or entities. A metaphor leaves a side description, cutting instead to the quick and associating one thing and another, which involves converting the meaning. I like using metaphors. One time I was preparing a lecture at the State University of New York. I planned to use metaphors to evoke different types of narratives in one of my classes there. Suddenly, I realized I was facing a dilemma. One of my students was 90% blind. What would be the point of using verbal metaphors, referring to objects he may never have seen? Perhaps I could find a way to use tactile metaphors, which he could hold in his hands. This called for a creative experiment. I took a ball of string out of a cupboard at home. I went to the dollar store and bought a shiny sky blue ball. I'd just returned from a documentary series in the Sahara, so I brought along a sand rose. These were my metaphors. When class started, I told the students we could imagine three different kinds of narrative structures. First, I handed the blind student the ball of string. I suggested a linear narrative structure was like a piece of string, and as he stretched it out, he noticed it proceeded from A to B to C in a long chain of causes and effects, one thing leading to another. Then I handed that student the shiny sky blue ball. I suggested an idealized narrative structure was like a sphere, polished without imperfections, projecting an impression of the world the way we wished it could be. He noticed the sphere was a perfect shape. Nothing could be added to it or subtracted from it. Every point on its surface was equidistant from its center. Just how perfect was the sphere? While he held the ball, I explained that in ancient Greece, the sphere was considered to have a magical and even a supernatural character. According to Anaximander in the 6th century BC, the earth was a cylinder, freely floating in space, and heaven was a sphere. Pythagoras, in the same century, held that the earth was a perfect sphere, rotating around a central fire, and Xenophanes, in the 6th and early 5th centuries, believed there was one God, coextensive with the world, and God was a sphere. These beliefs about heaven, the earth, and God were based on idealized projections. Then I handed the blind student a sand rose, and he found it really intriguing. He noticed it was a massive, sharp-edged riot of gypsum crystals facing in every direction. I suggested this was like a complex narrative structure, multifaceted, trying to be true to life and representing personalities and events with layers and depth. The blind student said he understood these tactile metaphors perfectly, so the experiment worked. And in describing the observations he made with his hands, he offered insights to the class. He turned out to be one of the top students in the class and got an A- at the end of term. I told the class that authors choose between linear, idealized, and complex narrative structures, sometimes combining and rearranging them, since narrative unity is all-important. I think my personal preference is somewhere between the sphere and the sand rose. I picture the sphere as something like Shakespeare's Little Worlds. In each play, he creates a perfect, make-believe, self-contained microcosm out of nothing. And as long as the play lasts, we are cast under a spell. We inhabit that little world along with the players. And the sand rose? Well, life is complex, and some things are hard to explain. But the idea of a riot of crystals facing every which way appeals to me. But what really is a metaphor beyond a transfer or an exchange? Our modern English word metaphor goes back to ancient Greek by way of classical Rome and Renaissance France. In ancient Greece, Aristotle writes, "Metaphor consists in giving the thing a name that belongs to something else, the transference being either from genus to species, or from species to genus, or from species to species, or on grounds of analogy." In the late 20th century, the French philosopher Paul Ricoeur writes that metaphors are complex figures of speech that involve aspects both of resemblance and of reference, and even, in some cases, of the substitution of one thing for the other. The Belgian rhetorical critics Chaim Perlman and Lucie Ulbricht-Titeka note that metaphors create a kind of symmetry and even a fusion of the two terms. So there's a whole range of understandings of the metaphor, from transfer to analogy, from resemblance to substitution, from symmetry to fusion. I don't see metaphor in quite the same way as Aristotle, Ricoeur, Perelman, or Olbrecht Titeka. I believe metaphors may be used as intuitive descriptions, as equations or identities between two terms, and even as prescriptions of how things ought to be. The difficulty with metaphor is that these crossovers from description to equation to prescription seem to operate at an unconscious level. I would like to come back to the original meaning of the Greek word metaphora. You go to the counter of Western Union in Athens to transfer money to someone overseas. That explains the sign, metaphora chrimaton, hanging above the door. Will you transfer euros or US dollars to that person overseas, or some other currency? What if you send too much money? Can the person overseas transfer some of the funds back to you? And what currency will they use? Metaphors can work in both directions. I remember interviewing Ray Kurzweil, who's certainly a genius, an innovator, a pioneer of artificial intelligence as we know it today. I was very struck by one comment he made, namely, that the time would soon come when computers had mastered human functions so perfectly that it would be impossible not to see computers as human. I have the impression he started off with a metaphor, the person is a machine, and after years of working in the field, he concluded with the metaphor, the machine is a person. Of course, I don't agree. What about myth and metaphor in science nowadays? Consider symbolic code at the expository level of meaning. A, C, G, and T are the letters of the genetic code. These four letters account for the nucleotide bases of DNA. Then consider symbolic code at the narrative level of meaning. One time, Sir John Sulston told me the Human Genome Project would establish the blueprint for the human species. Another time, he told me he felt like an archaeologist deciphering ancient clay tablets in the desert of Mesopotamia. So he was happy to use symbols and metaphors, that is, storytelling, to give a sense of the significance and adventure of scientific discovery. And that's just fine. So in this podcast, I've touched on our approach to language, on the different modes of writing, and on the places in the imagination where fiction comes from. I've also shared with you some ideas about the two pillars of storytelling, myth and metaphor. That's it for this episode of the Dream World series. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm going to continue with part two next week. If you would like to know more about my ongoing creative works, from books, translations, films, and blogs to Wildtrekker, check out my author's website at www.evidencia.net. And Evidencia is spelled E-V-I-D-E-N as in normal, T-I-A. The opening theme at the beginning of each Wildtrekker podcast is sung by Marie Frenette, with me accompanying her on the piano. Now here's Marie Frenette singing the closing theme of Wild Tracker, accompanied by Pascal Desmel on the guitar. Let's get together soon. This Wild Tracker episode is copyright 2020, George Toombs. All rights reserved.